Under the Hood.
Welcome to Under the Hood. I'm your host, Will, and I'm here with Sam Kashteman. Sam, what are we talking about today?
Today we're going to be talking about a section of the Exodus that a lot of skeptics, you'll hear around like, oh, the Hebrews, the Israelites were never in Egypt. They were never enslaved. And so in recent years and decades, there's been a lot of evidence that's come forward that's, you know, it might be circumstantial evidence, but when you look at it in the whole and you put it all together, it's like hand in glove. It just makes such good sense that the Exodus is a real thing that happened and the Israelites were truly enslaved in the land of Egypt.
Yeah, and this isn't one of those silver bullet episodes where we're going to find one thing where you're like, whoa, but as you put the whole package together and you use a little bit of common sense and not be trying to force an opinion onto it, it really is wild what they find.
Totally. And when you look at all of the evidence as it comes together, it becomes more difficult not to believe the idea that the Israelites were enslaved in Egypt than to say, okay, all the evidence fits. The Bible is correct on this one.
Okay, so where do we start?
At the very beginning of the book of Exodus, we are told that the Israelites were enslaved in the land of Egypt, and we're told specifically that they're not building pyramids, they're not building statues of Pharaoh, they're building store cities, and they list two of them, Pithom and Ramses. And so archaeologists can say, okay, let's go on the hunt to find these two cities and see what's there, which they have done. Now, storage cities, what are storage cities? Well, if you know the book of Genesis, it ends with Joseph in a town of Ramses, and he has established this place where he is selling grain to the rest of the world, which is in famine. So when it talks about a storage city, we should find lots of grain and silos and stuff like that. Well, when you go to this location, that's exactly what you find. There's an archaeologist who came from the University of Vienna, and they went and they dug at Ramses, which Avaris and Ramses are right side by side. So they're digging in Avaris, but this is the ancient city of Ramses. It's like, you know, we would say New York, but a few hundred years ago, they'd say New Amsterdam, same place, right? So when they're digging there, they're coming across this idea, like the city's overwhelmed with all these silos and granaries. And so the lead archaeologist from the University of Vienna writes this. I'll just read straight from his report. He says, a residential quarter with several buildings with attached courtyards and granaries separated by the streets was unearthed in the uppermost layer, which can be dated to the very end of the second intermediate period. Now, this is right at the beginning of the 18th dynasty, which is when you find Moses and the Exodus. All of a sudden, this city now becomes this massive city that's devoted to the storage of grain. And he writes, small brick-lined storage caves were under the floor. So it's not just that they're building silos all over the cities. They've got caves that are going underneath the floor where they're storing grain. Then he goes around and he says, there's a massive storage compound in the ruins, and he says, in just what they had uncovered, they haven't excavated the whole city, but in what they'd uncovered, he says, there's at least 30 round grain silos on the south side of the city, and he writes, quote, this amenity was used to store enormous quantities of grain and probably other foodstuff for a considerable number of people. It could have been a makeshift military facility for supplying troops. So this grain city, this store city, which is exactly what the Bible says it is so massive that it can give the supply lines for the entire Egyptian army as they're going on their expeditions up into the Syro-Palestine area. So the Bible tells us it's a store city. You go there, it's a store city. So we know Ramses is. When they go to Pithom, that is also filled with granaries, and it was a makeshift store city. So that's the first thing. And when you go out and you look at the living quarters, there's an area where the wealthy live that was close to the Nile River. And that's where you find the palatial estates and things that are really good. But as you back away, you see that all of the later buildings that come after that, they're all thin-walled. They're slave huts. They are very, very, very crudely put together. And the people who lived in them would have been exceptionally poor. And so even though this is a city where you do find incredible wealth and industry coming out of the city, which is what you'd expect from a store city, you also find enormous amounts of slave labor in this city.
And it makes sense for these pharaohs who were scared of famines that started the book of Exodus to be like, oh no, we need a supply line just in case this ever goes dry.
That's right. You look at the writings of the ancient pharaohs and what's written in their tombs. if a pharaoh is really successful, he will say, you know, during my reign, we never had a famine. That was kind of one of the great marks of a successful pharaoh, is the people didn't starve to death during my reign. And so once you come across Joseph, which is 400 years before Moses, all of a sudden, the policies of Egypt turn, and you see lots of this kind of mindset where we need to be prepared for the famines. So then the question becomes like, okay, we have a store city, and it just so happens that it's both Ramses and Pithom, which is exactly what the Bible says. But then the question is, how do we know they're Hebrew slaves? Were the Israelites ever there? Because no one would deny, okay, Egyptians had slaves, and they built store cities. Great, but what makes this the Hebrews? Well, there's some evidence to that. Like in the Brooklyn Museum, there's an ancient papyrus that came from Egypt, and it's actually a slave registry where an owner who had bought and owned slaves is recording the names of his slaves. And when you go through this list, there's 77 names listed that he owned. 48 of them are Semitic, meaning they came from that region of Canaan or Israel, and their names are Semitic, which suggests, okay, the slaves are not African in origin. They're coming from Syro-Palestine, which fits the Bible. It's Semitic.
Okay, so we did an episode on the plagues. We saw that there's evidence that the plagues happened, and now we're seeing that there is true evidence in the ground that the Hebrews were enslaved in Egypt. But a huge part of the story is not just that they were enslaved, but the actual Exodus. So do we have any evidence that the Exodus happened?
Again, this is circumstantial evidence, but when you look at it, I mean, it lends itself to the fact that there was something that happened where these towns just emptied out. And so if you look at the biblical timeline, we know that the Exodus, you know, if you do the timeline of when we should expect to find it, the biblical Exodus happened during the 18th dynasty. And most scholars believe that the pharaoh of the Exodus was a guy named Amenhotep II. And it's right at that time. So Manfred Bitek goes there. He's digging around Avaris. And when you're digging, you find evidence of when this city's occupied. You find something called scarabs, which have the names of different pharaohs on them that people would be buried by. And you can know, okay, the city was occupied during this time period, and you can dig and find, you know, going back in time when it was occupied. Well, listen to the report of Manfred Bitek, who's from the University of Vienna, who, by the way, is not a believer. Like, he never writes, oh, this is the Exodus or anything else. But when you look at the reports, it just lends itself to it. So listen to what he writes. He says, the archaeological material stops abruptly with the early 18th dynasty. There are no scarabs, those little scarabs we talked about that people would be buried with, of the 18th dynasty type in stratum D2, which is the next layer. He says, the most likely interpretation is that Avaris, which is Ramses, was just abandoned. Gee. A city that's filled with massive numbers of slave quarters all of a sudden is just emptied and abandoned. And he goes on, he says, there's no conflagration, which means like it wasn't burned with fire. There's no evidence that a war took it out. It wasn't conquered. There wasn't some great, you know, plague that left everybody dead here. He says there's no conflagration layer or corpses of slain soldiers that have been found so far in the large and widely separated excavation areas. And then listen to what he says. Remember who the pharaoh of the Exodus is, we think? It's Amenhotep II. He goes on and he says, we do not know if the settlement continued beyond the time of Amenhotep II. Well, that's pretty specific, right? You've got all these pharaohs of all the different dynasties. You have this huge slave population, Semitic names, burial practices that were from the Hebrews. Like they would be buried in sleeping positions. You know, like the Egyptian posture of burial is on your back. And if you're noble or of royal descent, your arms would be crossed. But Hebrews and people from Syro-Palestine would sleep in the fetal, like they would be buried in the fetal position because they believed that death was like sleep. And you were going to wake up. They were people who believed in a coming resurrection, that they were going to be raised. And so you were buried in the posture of sleep. These slaves were buried like that. And so then you go over to the city of Pithom. Okay, so Ramses totally emptied out. It's almost like there was a exodus, right? You go to the city of Pithom, which is modern-day Tel el-Rataba, and it was named Pithom because back in those cities, you like Pi Ramses is also what Ramses is called. Well, it was Pi Atom, which was the Egyptian god for the sun, Pi Atom, which got shortened to Pithom, right? They go and they dig there, and what they find is exactly the same thing. And so the archaeologists write that this city also has a sudden, quote, occupational hiatus, where everything just disappears. And when did that happen? Most probably from the time of Thutmose III. he's the Pharaoh that reigns right in front of Amenhotep II. So right at that time, he would have been the Pharaoh that Moses ran from in his early life. So right at the time of this particular, these two pharaohs, during the 18th dynasty, right when all the stuff of Exodus is happening, you have two different archaeological teams that are like, all the slaves disappeared. Gee, and there's no conflagration layer. There's no great explanation for why they left. They're just gone, and we have no archaeological record of why. Which fits, like any other city that's just totally abandoned like that. I mean, even the royal palace that was there at the Nile is abandoned during that time. Like, this city just dies for a while until Ramses II and the 19th dynasty resurrects this city. Why does that happen? So I can't say, well, definitively I have the video evidence of the Hebrews leaving, but you put it together, they have no explanation for why all this happens. They don't come to the table. The skeptics don't say, well, here's why, because there is no other explanation. So also in the city of Pithom, we know that it's a slave city, and they write, like, this was a larger group of people, and they lived in, quote, small huts with very thin walls, and they say the city was abandoned for unknown reasons between the reign of Thutmose III and Ramses II. So right during that time period, like we talked about, it's a slave city, very poor people, servants. There's silos all over the city of grain because it's a store city. And then poof, they're all gone right at the exact time that you should expect for that to happen. And one of the interesting things is they're going around the city of Pithom. You remember what the Hebrews are doing? In the book of Exodus, we're told that they're making bricks, right? And so Pharaoh, to punish them for demanding freedom, he says, okay, now you're going to make bricks, but you're going to have to go get your own straw. So we know what they're doing. They're making bricks to build the structures of this fortified city. Well, you go to Pithom, and there's this really peculiar discovery that comes along. In 1905, an archaeologist named Sir William Petrie is going through, and he's excavating these bricks. And he finds along the wall, and sometimes inside the wall, slain infants that are buried inside the wall. And he's shocked by that, because, like, if you look at cultures that do child sacrifice, you got to go up to, like, Syria. You got to look at the Canaanites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, all those wicked tribes that are up in the north. But he's like, the Egyptians don't do that. Like, we have no period of history where Egypt is actually slaying children. And it's like, press the brakes. Because I seem to know a story that happens in the Bible, in the book of Exodus, where you have Pharaoh telling his soldiers, because the Hebrews are growing too numerous, what's the solution?
Slaughter babies.
Slaughter babies. And so you come to this city, and we actually have found intact skeletons of these babies that were put in burial jars, buried alongside the walls made of bricks that would have been formed by these slaves. So at the time where they're building store cities, these babies are getting slaughtered. It's more circumstantial evidence, but the solution lends itself to our conclusion, not to the skeptics.
Okay, so we see these storage cities, we see the Exodus, and we see this mass abandonment of huge cities. And the major climactic moment of the Exodus is the Red Sea. So can we see any validity to that?
Well, actually, even before you get to the Red Sea, there's something that the skeptics had, like, a really good claim. First off, we're told that Moses is in a slave city, right? He goes back to the city of Ramses, and there he's confronting Pharaoh. And you have to ask yourself, okay, why is Pharaoh easily accessible in a slave city? Because in our mind, like, you look at Egyptian history, they're always either in Memphis to the south or Thebes, which is way to the south. And those are the capital cities of Egypt. So the idea that the Pharaoh is in a slave city, like, why would that happen? And so the archaeologists that dig through this region find that one of the very earliest pharaohs of the 18th dynasty built this palace that's right in the slave city, right alongside the Nile. Now you're going, wait a minute. When Moses was born, we're told that his mother put him in a basket and put him out into a river. He floated away, he's got caught in the reeds, and Pharaoh's daughter is coming out to the Nile. And you're thinking, why would Pharaoh's daughter be near the Nile in a slave city? She should be down in Thebes. But they discovered that Thutmose I actually built a palace in that city. And sure enough, right at the time of Moses' birth, Pharaoh would have had a palace there. So that makes sense, right? In addition to that, you're thinking, okay, if the Hebrews leave the slave city and Pharaoh, we're told that he pursues them. In fact, the Bible says he took 600 of his best chariots, select chariots, which means they probably had extra spokes. Maybe they were made of metal components. along with all the other chariots of Egypt. So 600 of the really good ones, and then a whole bunch of that's a massive, massive chariot army in the ancient world, right? To go into battle with that many, that's huge. And so the question would be, yeah, right.
Yeah, okay. Like how?
If you're going to have that big of an army, it's going to be in your capital city. It's going to be down in Thebes. So you're telling me the Hebrews leave. Pharaoh's like, oh, we're going to pursue them. He dispatches a messenger who's going to travel 500 miles down to Thebes. Hey, we need chariots. And then the chariots are going to travel the 500 miles back. Like, the Hebrews are long gone. You're not going to catch them. So the only way that the chariots could have caught up with them by the Red Sea is if chariots were handy and ready to go. That's a big ask. Until a archaeologist who is a professor at Boston University, her name's Catherine Bard, started doing more archaeological digs, and she goes to a city that's 2 kilometers. 2 kilometers is nothing, right? Right outside the ancient city of Ramses, and there, listen to what she writes. She says, the first fully preserved stratum at Kantir, the name of this little town, contains the remains of the first chariot garrison ever excavated in the Near East. So the whole region, Egypt, Near East, all of it. She says, including evidence of foreigners, some 400 artifacts were found which can be associated with chariots. So, and tethering stones, these humongous boulders where they would tie up their horses, you find a ton of them all over the place. So this place was the garrison place where the Pharaoh kept all of his chariots because they were invasion forces to go up into the northeast and to conquer all of that region of Canaan. And so at this particular time period, you've got this massive garrison of chariots and horses ready to go that's 2 kilometers, that makes a lot more sense, away from Pharaoh's palace that when the Hebrews bail and he's like, nah, we're going to pursue them, it's not a big ordeal of sending someone 500 miles to Thebes. It's 2 kilometers. It's barely across town to Kantir to say, round them up, we're going after them. And so that seems to fit. Like, that works. But then the question of, like, do we have evidence of the Exodus? And there's some archaeologists who don't have a lot of credibility that claim to have found, you know, chariot axles in the bottom of the Red Sea. And I'm gonna leave that for people to make their own judgments about. But one of the things that I find really compelling is there's a city called Mycenae, which is up in Greece. It's one of the ancient Aegean cities. And they have what are called grave circles where they would bury their royalty and their nobles. And, I mean, you can go there to this day. When they're excavating these grave circles, they find scarabs and jewelry that are from the 18th dynasty of Egypt. Pharaohs like Amenhotep II have stuff that's buried in Mycenae, which shows you that they not only had communication with one another, but they were trading partners back and forth from Egypt to the Aegean city of Mycenae. One of the things they found in the grave circles that was only a short distance away from the jewelry for Amenhotep II are these steles, which have drawings on them, inscriptions. Now, they date to 1500 BC, which is right in the approximate time of when you should find Moses, because they didn't have newspapers back then. So they're inscribing on these stone pillars. And you can see in the image, here's a man in a chariot who is chasing another man who's holding a stick, a spear, a staff of some sort. And you notice on the bottom, there's these swirly cues. And on the top, there's swirly cues, which means that this chariot is giving chase between waters. Can you think of anything in Exodus where that sounds familiar? Like, that's the parted Red Sea when Pharaoh's army rushes in to chase after the Hebrews. You could imagine a chariot chasing a man who's holding a staff in between the waters. Well, you get to the next one of these stela, and you see that the waters are still on top, so on one side. The waters are on the other side, but notice that right in between, as the man who's holding the stick goes past, now all of a sudden, bizarrely, this water is now collapsing down onto the chariot. What is that? Like a skeptic, and in real life, the skeptics say, this is portraying a hunting party. And it's like, well, hunting, what are they hunting? It looks like he's hunting the man. Like, you know, there's no animals. There's nothing there. Like, this is a man chasing in a chariot, chasing another man who's holding a stick between bodies of water, and water's collapsing on the one. Like, that does not sound like a hunting party that I've ever been a part of. And so you see here that going back, you have what we talked about in the plagues episodes, the Ippawar Papyrus. There's a good bit of evidence that shows you that this happened. Some great event happened in Egypt that makes sense of this.
And I think one of the more obscure parts of the narrative that we find in the book of Exodus is the fact that the Bible takes time to describe that it wasn't just the Israelites who left, the enslaved people who left, but people came along with them that were not of that descent. Do we see that?
We actually know that to be true now. So when you look at it, it says in the book of Exodus that it's not just the Israelites that come up. Like, remember, the whole purpose of the plagues was to show them that their gods were no gods at all, to come and trust in the Lord, to know that he is God. And sure enough, the Bible tells us in Exodus 12, verse 38, many other people went up with them. And then in the aftermath of that we know that after Moses died, Moses's wife died, he takes a Cushite wife, which would have been an African woman, to the south of Egypt, and he marries her. And then Moses gives the law, and he's saying, you shall not detest an Egyptian because you are an alien in his land. The sons of the third generation who are born to them may enter into the assembly of the Lord. And so they have all of these rules about how to incorporate foreigners into the covenant promises of Israel, to be circumcised, to be part of the tabernacle and worship. So foreigners were coming out with them. And here's something that's interesting. Harvard Medical School went around to seven different Jewish populations that are around the world with kind of distinct heritages. And one of the things they found when they did the DNA mapping, and I'm just going to read this so I don't mess it up, says each of the populations contained 3-5% of African DNA sequence patterns dating back on average more than 100 generations. So if you go to the time when the Jews were scattered, when Babylonians conquered them in 586 and scattered them all over the place, and the Assyrians before that scattered them all over the place, before that moment, their bloodline was already mixed with African DNA. So the report from Harvard says this: the Jewish groups descend from a common ancestral population, which was itself admixed with Africans prior to the beginning of the Jewish diaspora that occurred in the 8th to 6th century BC. What does that mean? That means that when the Jewish nation was formed, there was a significant portion of African bloodline in them. Can you think of a time when the Jews may have been down in Africa to where their entire genetic DNA as a people group suddenly changes to mirror that? Like, so they were in Africa. They had massive influence. You don't see that with other genetic groupings. But you do see that with the Jews. They were in Africa.
Okay, if I'm tracking this correctly, Pharaoh loses almost everything in this moment, right? The Exodus takes away his slaves. It seems like the Exodus takes away 600-plus chariots, which would have been huge military resources. Do we see the effects of that kind of resources being taken away from Pharaoh?
In addition to that, remember the plagues take the livestock. This would have been a monumental moment that would have changed the trajectory of Egypt. Because if we're right that it's Thutmose III and it's Amenhotep II that are the two pharaohs at play in Moses' story, Thutmose III is one of the most impressive pharaohs in all of Egyptian history. He's called the Napoleon of Egypt. He's a military dynamo. Egypt is on the ascending track. They're becoming more powerful. And then all of a sudden, we should find like that stops, and they fall into decline in a hurry. And that's exactly what we find. But here first, Pharaoh doesn't die in the Red Sea.
That's shocking to me. I've always read it like he's gone.
But let's read the passage. Pharaoh doesn't die. The Egyptians pursued, this is from Exodus 14 to 15, the Egyptians pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea. And listen to what it says, because it doesn't say Pharaoh. It says, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. So this Pharaoh, who's so arrogant, is a coward. He sends his people into this scary, moment, and then he stays back, and they all die. It says, the waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen and all the host of Pharaoh, but never lists Pharaoh being dead. And when you go to this particular time, Amenhotep II actually reigns for a considerable time after that. But here's something that's interesting. If you look at Thutmose III, he leads 17 different military campaigns. He's always at war, always invading, always conquering. When you look at the early years of Amenhotep II, his early years, he has three military campaigns where he is going after and conquering and conquering. And yet, the moment you have the time of the Exodus, after those three, the majority of his reign, he retreats into himself, and Egypt is obviously in decline. He does the last, and this is fascinating to me, the last mission that he does. He's going into a vassal territory that his dad had already conquered. And listen to what he writes about in his records. He says, that he seized horses and livestock without limit. Why does he make a special mission to go seize horses and livestock? None of the other pharaohs have records like this, but there's this severe shortage of horses and livestock in Egypt to where he's making a special mission out of it. And then listen to this. He seizes 1,092 chariots.
He needs those.
Why, right? Like, he's just lost his entire chariot army and 101,128 foreign slaves in his final campaign into what's called the Levant, which was up near the Sea of Galilee, actually, which is 46 times more slaves than all the other campaigns combined. So all of a sudden, in his last great effort, he's got to go find horses, he's got to go find livestock, he's got to go find chariots, and he gets this massive, unheard-of number of slaves, where even the Egyptologist scholars that look into this they're like, this must have been a typo or an exaggeration, because nobody went and rounded up this many slaves. But if it is the Pharaoh of the Exodus, and he's doing his one last hurrah before he shrinks back into his defeat, doesn't that make sense that he's going and plundering all the things that he's just lost in desperate measures? And so it's right during this time period that if you go to respected Egyptologists, they'll note Thutmose III on the rise, conquering all kinds of territory. And then you get to the first decade of a long reign. I think Amenhotep II reigns for 35 years. Within the first decade, he's done. He falls into decline. And so you got Egyptologists from Belgium, Claude Vanderslaan, who writes, it seems possible to consider his reign as unsuccessful, a time of decline, few exploits abroad, almost a complete absence of sources after the ninth year of his reign. So 9 into 35 years and all of it, he's done. There's no more about him. I mean, his dad's Thutmose III, and then all of a sudden he's done. Another guy, Yohanan Aharoni from Tel Aviv University, says, already in the days of Amenhotep II, the son of Thutmose III, cracks began to appear in the structure of the Egyptian empire. And these nemesis kingdoms that Egypt had, that Thutmose III had no problem with, all of a sudden, the successors of Amenhotep II are bribing them for peace because Egypt is so weakened. Like, please, we'll send you gold, but please don't invade us. Why? I mean, you're supposed to be the dominant empire. What changed from Thutmose III to the aftermath of Amenhotep II to where it's like, we'll give you money, don't invade us? They'd been devastated by some event. What do you think that was, Will?
Sure seems like the Exodus.
And it's just fascinating how you see some of this stuff show up later, like, one of the first recorded mentions of the name Yahweh is not just in the scriptures. The Egyptians, actually under Seti I, who's in the 19th dynasty, so one dynasty after all this happens, you have Seti I, who's referring to Ra by a new nickname, which is Yahweh, which in Egyptian means I am I. Like, it's this virtually the same name as Yahweh, but something had been imprinted in the Egyptian mind that this Yahweh was really powerful, so they give their own gods these nicknames. Like, no, our God is really Yahweh. Why is that? You find ancient records that date back to 1390 BC under the reign of Amenhotep III, so two pharaohs after Amenhotep II, that refer to the land of Shasu, which Shasu is a word that means wanderer. So some group is out there wandering around. Does that sound familiar? Because after the Exodus, what do they do for 40 years?
Lots of wandering.
They're wandering around in the wilderness. And so this is referring to the land of the Shasu, the wanderers of Yahweh. So here you have ancient Egyptian records that are referring to the Israelites as wandering around and that their God is Yahweh. That fits like a glove. Like, and why is he concerned with them? In other places in Egyptian records, one of the oldest mentions of the nation of Israel comes in what's called the Merneptah Stele, and it actually mentions Israel as a nation. This would have been after Joshua's leading the conquest. And it just so happens also that right at the tail end of the 18th dynasty, after you would have seen Yahweh, the first monotheistic god in the world, all of a sudden Egypt has this pharaoh who comes along and throws all of the polytheistic gods out and says, no, we are now monotheistic. And his name's Akhenaten. He's the one monotheistic pharaoh. Like, what would have put it in his mind to all of a sudden say, no, we want to be monotheistic? There's all of this stuff that's happening, and it's circumstantial, but you hear the buzz going on, and it's like, okay, come on. Like, this looks a lot like the Exodus. And one of the other things that I never get an answer from skeptics about is they're like, the Hebrews were never in Egypt. Like, we refuse to acknowledge that. Okay, well, let me ask you this question then. I'd love an answer for this. The Israelites have no history before the Great Conquest, right? They're not in Egypt, though. We don't know where they were. They just came out of some other dimension, apparently. But all of a sudden, when Joshua and his successors lead the conquest into the Promised Land, there's these really cool things called the Amarna letters. Now, you remember Thutmose III had conquered all that region. So all these cities pay their tributes to Egypt, right? Now, all of a sudden, you get to the Amarna letters. You have 300 different settlements all of a sudden that just explode, that are all of a sudden Hebrew settlements. Where'd they come from? Who are these people? But Yohanan Aroni, I just mentioned him, from Tel Aviv University, says, there's no doubt in my opinion that this wave of settlement from the beginning of the Iron Age is all Israelite. And so these letters that are like flares, all these cities start saying, Pharaoh, we need help, we need help. There's these invaders coming, we need your help. And you know who they say is invading? They give them a name, and the name is the Habiru. Does that sound like anything?
Just like the Hebrews.
Hebrew. The Habirus are invading. The Habirus are invading. And so Dr. Frank Moore Cross, who is the distinguished Hancock professor of Hebrew and Oriental languages at Harvard, says this, the Habiru, is the origin of the term Hebrew. It just is. So all of a sudden, you got Hebrews that show up out of nowhere, enough of them for 300 different settlements that invade the land, and all these cities, including Jerusalem and others, are going, the Habiru are coming, the Habiru are coming. And let me just give you some excerpts from that. The war against me is severe. This is from Jerusalem's king. The war against me is severe. The Habiru have plundered all the lands of the king, just like you find in Joshua chapter 10. Another tablet warned Pharaoh that all the lands of the king as far as Egypt will be joined to the Habiru. In other words, there's so many of them that just came out of nowhere. You know, they're conquering all the entire region of the Promised Land, coming down from the border of Egypt through Jerusalem. They're up in Shechem. Like, they're all over the place. And so, like, the question that I want to ask, if these are the Hebrews, where'd they come from? Where were they before the conquest? Like, Egypt tells us that they were the Shasu, so they spent some time wandering for a while. We know that from the Bible. But where were they before the wandering? And the only answer I can find, gee, maybe they were in a city that was suddenly abandoned, where all of the slaves that were building store cities in Egypt, in the city of Ramses, in the city of Pithom, in the region of Goshen, suddenly vanished. Gee, that sounds like the story of the Exodus. And so I don't think we have to be afraid of this. Is there like direct evidence where you find nameplate? I, so-and-so, the Hebrew was a slave. Like, we're not going to find that. But you put all of these pieces together and it becomes harder to believe that it didn't happen than that it did. One of the other things, like one of the cities that the Hebrews took was the city of Shechem, except what made Shechem different is the Hebrews didn't conquer it. Like if you look in Joshua chapter 21, when the Hebrews come to Shechem, the people of Shechem surrender the city so they don't have to destroy it. And that's exactly what you find in the Amarna letters. Listen to what they write to Pharaoh. It says, now shall we do as Labayu, who gave the land of Shechem to the Habiru. So it's another city saying, should we surrender our city just like Shechem surrendered it to the Hebrews? It matches what we find in all of these details. Like, these are the Hebrews. It's pretty evident to me.
And again, it's really amazing that we can trust what the Bible gives us, that we can look at the things in the ground that these great archaeologists dig up, and they're not even looking to prove the Bible, but it's just the earth is really showing what the Bible talks about. And I think the Exodus is one of those really killer ones where you're like you said, like, you cannot believe this, but that would be hard to do.
I agree. I totally agree. And one of the things that this does, just because we always want to end pointing to Jesus, this whole story is a story where God is coming to deliver enslaved people in a land of death and to deliver them out into the new promise. And that's the mission of what Jesus does for us. He has come to deliver us from our slavery under the tyranny of the serpent and to deliver us out into a brand new land and to lead us into a promised land. And all of this is kind of the physical dry run for what Jesus will do for us in the spiritual sense. So we have one far greater than Moses and far greater than Joshua.
That's awesome. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you so much for watching. Join us next time on Under the Hood as we look at another story in the Bible.
And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. Thanks, guys.